Hello, this is Auntie Bee's Knees with your business report for the week of October 27th. The G20 group of the world's wealthiest nations met last weekend in Morelia, Mexico. Host and Mexican Treasury Secretary Francisco Gil Diaz opened the conference with sharp criticism of U.S. domination of the global economy. According to Diaz, the global economy is too dependent on U.S. growth, one of several vulnerabilities in international finance that need to be overcome by government policies and measures to create a, quote, more balanced and sustainable growth path, end quote. Opening this annual meeting of the Group of 20 Nations, Diaz said that the two-day event would seek to find ways of helping the world economy to recover. But little time was spent at the summit cooking up policies to curb America's stranglehold on international capitalist exploitation. Rather, assembled finance ministers discussed ways to block funding for so-called terrorist groups. At its last two summits, the G20 has agreed to try and cut off illegal financing for radical groups, but little progress has been made. Now discussion is focusing on ways of curtailing and monitoring financial transactions made using the hawala system. Hawala is a paperless, informal money transfer common to the Islamic world, in which a paid contact in one country arranges a cash payout in another country. The focus on hawala underlies the G20's racist assumptions about what constitutes a terrorist organization. For example, little attention is being paid to how U.S. banks such as Citigroup bankroll drug trafficking and right-wing terrorist groups in Latin America. And while the G20 was plotting ways to curb funding for Al-Qaeda at last weekend's summit, it was simultaneously contemplating billions of dollars in handouts to fund so-called reconstruction projects in Iraq. Run by what has been described as the world's most dangerous terrorist group, the administration of U.S. President George Walker Bush. U.S. Treasury Secretary John Snow spent most of last weekend panhandling for donations from the G20's other finance ministers. Snow is reported to have held private meetings with officials from Germany, China, Argentina, Russia, Mexico, Turkey, South Africa, and France, urging them to support U.S.-led reconstruction efforts. Snow arrived in Mexico fresh from a rather dismal two-day conference in Madrid, Spain, where he managed to convince only a handful of officials gathered from 77 nations to cough up a total of $13 billion in new aid for Iraq. The money includes $5 billion in grants and loans pledged by Japan, $500 million in new funding from Kuwait, $500 million in loans and an equal amount in export credits from Saudi Arabia, $812 million from the European Union, and $100 million from Canada. Apart from Japan, the largest contributors to U.S.-led reconstruction efforts in Iraq are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, who will together shell out up to $9 billion over the next 5 years. Snow's campaign to win international support for U.S. occupation and reconstruction in Iraq has been blighted by the Pentagon's mismanagement of reconstruction efforts and by the Bush administration's unilateral approach to foreign policy. A World Bank official recently told the New York Times that European countries in particular are concerned that the U.S.-led Coalition Provision Authority, or CPA, is the sole decision-making power in Iraq. Quote, for political reasons, they don't want their funds to be perceived as being commingled with funds controlled by the CPA. They want their own say over how money is spent, end quote. Just before the U.S. invaded Iraq, post-war administration efforts were handed to the Pentagon-controlled CPA, rather than the U.S. State Department, which would normally oversee such efforts. Soon after major combat operations ended, it became clear that the Pentagon had based its post-war plans on 1991 Gulf War scenarios. The first head of the reconstruction team, retired U.S. General Jay Garner, led U.S. efforts in northern Iraq in 1991. This time around, Garner stockpiled food, tents, and medical supplies and employed teams of wildcat oil field specialists to cap potential oil well fires. But relatively little was done to prepare for a return to civilian administration in Iraq. Reconstruction priorities were set by U.S. occupying forces rather than Iraqi administrators. Programs to reestablish the legal system and return government ministries to normal operations were kept out of the picture. The training of local police was left up to the Canadian government, who finally volunteered for the job last week. Questions regarding staffing, spending, and opaque decision-making within the CPA eventually led Bush to appoint security advisor Condoleezza Rice as head of an Iraq stabilization group earlier this month. The group is expected to, quote-unquote, crack the whip at officials leading Iraqi reconstruction efforts in Washington and Baghdad. Most of the CPA's efforts in Iraq have been bankrolled by a U.S.-controlled development fund. The fund was created by the UN last May to replace the UN's Oil for Food program. The fund is administered by U.S. officials, and its money is kept in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. All of the former Iraqi government's assets deposited anywhere in the world, and all past and future revenues from the sale of Iraqi oil are to be turned over to this fund. To pad the fund, U.S. officials plan to auction off most of Iraq's formerly state-owned industries in a massive privatization scheme. The fund is being used not only to pay for reconstruction projects in Iraq, but to allow the U.S. Export and Import Bank to extend credit to U.S. companies hoping to buy out Iraq's nationalized corporations or to start businesses in the war-torn country. About $1 billion worth of assets were transferred to the fund from the Oil for Food program in May, and an additional $5 billion has gone into the fund so far. But according to a report by Christian Aid in the UK, more than $4 billion of this has gone missing. No process exists to monitor how money from the fund is spent, a proposed oversight committee has not been appointed, and no auditing mechanism is in place for the fund. In short, the development fund gives carte blanche to the Pentagon to defend and expand U.S. corporate interests in Iraq. Debate over the Pentagon's management of post-war Iraq has been fueled by further controversy as the Pentagon has awarded lucrative reconstruction contracts to firms with close ties to the Bush administration. USAID regulations require that only U.S. contractors can be hired for projects paid for with U.S. development funds. But even the U.S.-based companies granted contracts in Iraq were selected through secret backroom deals that favored corporations with close connections to the Bush administration. The most controversial contract went to Kellogg Brown & Root, a subsidiary of the Halliburton Oil Services Company that U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney used to work for. In March, Kellogg Brown & Root was awarded an unlimited no-bid contract to repair Iraq's oil infrastructure. Another major contract for rebuilding Iraq's ports, power stations, telephone lines, and water supply was awarded in April to Bechtel, a company with close ties to George Shultz, Secretary of State under George Bush Sr. Needless to say, it has been difficult for companies from outside the U.S. to win contracts for work in Iraq. Iraqi firms themselves have been excluded from the bidding process, marking a significant failure by the CPA to rebuild Iraq's economy by providing economic opportunities for Iraqi business. A third criticism of the reconstruction process is that U.S. contractors are now overcharging the CPA for supplies. Kellogg Brown & Root charges $1.59 per gallon for gasoline imported from Turkey, whereas the going market rate in the Persian Gulf is 76 cents per gallon plus about 25 cents for transport. U.S. contractors and subcontractors are charging far higher rates for construction projects than Iraqi contractors would, as has been discovered through analysis of the Bush administration's proposed $20 billion aid package for Iraq. This $20 billion in so-called aid is part of an $87 billion package for Iraq that provides $65 billion for military occupation. The U.S. Congress cut back the Bush administration's request for reconstruction funds by nearly $1.5 billion to eliminate overpriced items like $50,000 garbage trucks and a $300 million prison. Most of the $20 billion aid package will pay for deals with U.S. companies, making this so-called aid little more than a handout to corporate America. Nonetheless, the U.S. Senate has voted to convert half of the proposed package into a loan, increasing Iraq's burden of foreign debt and forcing Iraqi people to pay for their country being overrun by U.S. corporate interests. Iraq is already the world's largest debtor, owing between $100 and $400 billion to foreign creditors. The country's economy has been crippled by 12 years of U.S.-led, U.N.-sponsored economic sanctions that began and ended with U.S.-led wars. But the U.S. Senate's decision to convert half of the proposed aid package into loans reveals not only the scope of U.S. corporate interests within the U.S. government. The 51-47 vote by the Republican-led Senate also reflects U.S. lawmakers' concerns that Bush is spending vast amounts of taxpayer dollars overseas while racking up record deficits at home, where state governments are unable to provide basic services and unemployment is increasing. The $10 billion loan voted for by the U.S. Senate could be converted back into a grant if France, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and other foreign creditors forgive at least 90% of Iraq's debt. But there appears little chance of this debt being forgiven. U.S. requests for aid from France, Germany, and Russia, who each opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, have so far met with an icy response. Saudi Arabia is providing its aid in the form of further loans and export credits, compounding the debt it is owed by Iraq. $3.5 billion of Japan's $5 billion in contributions will be administered as loans. Kuwait has promised a rather generous aid package, but is demanding ongoing war reparations from Iraq for the 1991 war. These reparations could amount to a sum far greater than the aid being granted. In fact, most of the $33 billion raised by the U.S. and its allies so far has been set as loans that will simply saddle Iraq with new debt, worsening its economic woes. And $33 billion is still well below the $56 billion estimate that the World Bank has said it will cost to restore Iraq to pre-1991 Gulf War conditions within 5 years. $33 billion is just a fraction of the $500 billion that the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments has calculated it will cost for non-military reconstruction in Iraq. Overall, the money contributed by international governments to reconstruction efforts in Iraq has fallen far short of what is necessary, mostly because potential donors mistrust U.S. policy in Iraq. To quell such fears, the World Bank and UN have set up a separate fund to manage international contributions for the reconstruction of Iraq. The new fund will only oversee non-U.S. donations, meaning that most reconstruction money remains under U.S. control. But most of the $13 billion raised in Madrid will enter the fund, managed by the World Bank, the UN, and a committee of Iraqis. The new fund is expected to give non-U.S. companies a greater role in the bidding process for reconstruction contracts in Iraq, granting donor countries a crack at multi-billion-dollar business opportunities in Iraq. In London 2 weeks ago, an investors' conference entitled Doing Business in Iraq, Kickstarting the Private Sector, attracted representatives from nearly 150 multinational corporations. The companies, mainly from the oil and banking sectors, were invited by the U.S. and British governments to move into Iraq as soon as security is restored. The conference was organized by the U.S.-Iraq Business Alliance, set up by the U.S. Treasury Department in October 2002 to facilitate the U.S.-led corporate takeover of Iraq. The conference closed with reports that McDonald's, among other multinational corporations, could begin operations in Iraq by 2005. Yes, Big Macs may be served up in Iraq as early as next year, but only after Bechtel has switched on the lights, Halliburton has rebuilt the bridges, Research Triangle Institute has trained the bureaucrats, and Motorola has set up the mobile phone network. The next Doing Business in Iraq conference is scheduled for Moscow this December, where corporations from outside the U.S. and U.K. will presumably be offered crumbs from the table of Iraq's occupying forces. The cracking open of Iraq's infrastructure to foreign investment and the privatization of Iraq's formerly state-owned industry comes as no surprise to observers of U.S.-led hypercapitalist expansion. The realities of post-war reconstruction efforts in Iraq lend further credence to the anti-war movement's claim that this war had nothing to do with weapons or dictators, and everything to do with asserting U.S. and British corporate interests in the Middle East. That's a wrap for this week's Business Report. Signing off, this is Auntie Beesneys reminding you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.